Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're going to be going through, like we talked about last week, we're going to be going through the Assumption Act first. And like I said yesterday, as a matter of fact, but we kind of laid out the curriculum last week. And so the Assumption Act is really the beginning of a huge ball of mess. There's probably a better metaphor for that, but it's just this huge mess that was created by Hamilton, and he literally duped Jefferson and Madison. And so what we're going to do, though, is let me actually introduce Eric. We got Eric Levy from Georgia, and we work with him. And actually, Eric has been on the show before. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, folks. Eric actually works with the National Liberty Alliance. He works with the Constitution Party. He works with us. So he's a man that has many connections, networking, talent, and so forth. And anyway, what we're going to do today is we're going to actually kind of peel this thing backwards. So we're going to see the end effect of what really Hamilton was trying to do. Hamilton was a brilliant man. He was a manipulator. He did some really good things, and I don't think he understood what was really going to happen, because I don't think he understood the makeup of the Federal Reserve as a permanent structure that would absolutely steal the wealth of America and hand it over to the globalists. And so, bottom line, what he became the proponent for, and it all started with the Assumption Act. So we're gonna actually go into Madison's argument against the National Bank. And as far as I'm concerned, he could have just ended with his very first line. And so when we kind of look at that, and as a matter of fact, we're using Eric like we use Paul. And we're going to let him do the primary reading. And so at this point, this is we're talking about the debates over the National Bank. Because they have, and the reason why we're starting here is we want to understand what the real argument was of what was happening on the end result of Madison or Hamilton's strategy, or Hamilton's, I'll say, stratagem. A stratagem is not just a strategy, but it is a deceitful strategy to get you to think you're going to be just doing one thing, when actually you end up doing something that's even greater, a more egregious violation. And so we'll kind of sum this all up and how this happens from a miniature violation to an egregious violation that becomes this festering sore that actually leads us to the Federal Reserve. So anyway, are you ready? Go ahead.
Yes.
Go ahead, Eric. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Madison began, "Is the power of establishing an incorporated bank among the powers vested by the Constitution in the legislature of the United States? This is the question to be examined. After some general remarks on the limitations of all political power, he took notice of the peculiar manner in which the federal government is limited. It is not a general grant out of which particular powers are accepted. It is a grant of particular powers only, leaving the general mass in other hands. So it had been understood by its friends and its foes, and so it was to be interpreted. As preliminaries to a right interpretation, he laid down the following rules. An interpretation that destroys a very characteristic of the government cannot be just. Where a meaning is clear, the consequences, whatever they may be, are to be admitted. Where doubtful, it is fairly triable by consequences. In controverted cases, the meaning of the parties to the instrument, if to be collected by reasonable evidence, is a proper guide. Contemporary and concurrent expositions are a reasonable evidence of the meaning of the parties. In admitting or rejecting a constructive authority, not only the degree of its incidentality to an express authority is to be regarded, but the degree of its importance also, since on this will depend the probability or improbability of its being left to construction. Reviewing the Constitution with an eye to these positions, it was not possible to discover in it the power to incorporate a bank. The only clauses under which such a power could be pretended are either 1. The power to lay and collect taxes to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare, or 2. The power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, or 3. The power to pass all laws necessary and proper to carry into execution those powers.
So let me stop you right there. And so, because this is where I'd like to do a little bit of analysis. So in reviewing the Constitution with an eye to these positions, it was not possible to discover it in the power to incorporate a bank. And he basically lays out the three particular clauses that one would try to use as a justification. The power to lay and collect taxes to pay the debts and provide for the common defense. In other words, the national defense system, you know, our navy, our fortresses, building up arms, that type of stuff. The next one was the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, or the power to pass all laws and proper to carry into execution those laws. The federal government does not need a bank to do these things. The difference between a bank and the roles and responsibilities that was delegated to the federal government was a federal government with a bank, or a federal bank then has the ability to loan. In other words, a bank is an institution that actually is a profiteering type of institution. It's an institution of profit. And when we look at the Federal Reserve, does the Federal Reserve not loan out money and assign interest to it? Now, what we've been seeing actually is the antithesis. They're actually using the Federal Reserve as a mechanism to spread wealth among, I will just say, those favored by the federal government. See, now that the federal government has the ability with the Federal Reserve to give some institutions favorable loans, in other words, giving them money with zero interest attached. And then the interest that they do make off of the Federal Reserve, that doesn't go into the Treasury. That actually goes into an international corporations or international entities that were set up as a part of the Federal Reserve. So clearly he laid out these three lines, and there is no justification whatsoever to create this type of institution. Does it mean that as an individual sovereign, the federal government that has sovereignty over very specific things delegated to it, does it mean that it can't go out and collect taxes and provide for the common defense? In other words, collecting taxes to spend money. Does it need a bank to do that? No, not at all. Does it need a bank to borrow money on the credit of the United States? No, we would actually go to a bank or another nation with money and actually be able to borrow that without having to have a bank. And the third clause, the power to pass all necessary and proper to carry into the execution of those powers. In other words, the aforementioned powers, I think, is the actual quote out of the necessary and proper clause. And to be honest, and to be clear, actually to be clear, no, they do not need a bank to do any of these things. They have the ability to take loans out from other institutions of government, and they have the ability to collect taxes to pay the debts. They don't, all they need, I mean, do you have your own bank, folks? How many people, how many businesses have their own banks? A bank is a very unique institution, but it is designed to make money. And so what ends up happening is that this bank actually defaults and it goes bankrupt in the early 1800s. John Adams was a heavy investor in this bank, along with a lot of other Americans, and they lost everything. And as you really look at the effect of this, then they had to create a new bank, and then we had this long run of national banks in one form or another, even with Andrew Jackson. So, okay, sorry for diving into that, but keep going now. Thank you, Eric.
Sure. The third clause is that which gives the power to pass all laws necessary and proper to execute the specific powers. Whatever meaning this clause may have, none can be admitted that would give an unlimited discretion to Congress. Its meaning must, according to the natural and obvious force of the terms and the context, be limited to means necessary to the end and incident to the nature of the specified powers. The clause is, in fact, merely declaratory of what would have resulted by unavoidable implication. As the appropriate, and as it were, technical means of executing those powers. In this sense, it had been explained by the friends of the Constitution and ratified by the state conventions. The essential characteristic of the government as composed of limited and enumerated powers would be destroyed if instead of direct and incidental means, any means could be used, which in the language of the preamble to the bill might be conceived to be conducive to the successful conducting of the finances or might be conceived to tend to give facility to the obtaining of loans. He urged an attention to the diffuse and ductile terms which had been found requisite to cover the stretch of power contained in the bill. He compared them with the terms necessary and proper used in the Constitution and asked whether it was possible to view the two descriptions as synonymous or the one as fair and safe commentary. The latitude of interpretation required by the bill is condemned by the rule furnished by the Constitution itself. It is not pretended that every insertion or omission in the Constitution is the effect of systematic attention. This is not the character of any human work, particularly the work of a body of men. The examples cited with others that might be added sufficiently inculcate, nevertheless, a rule of interpretation very different from that on which the bill rests. They condemn the exercise of any power, particularly a great and important power, which is not evidently and necessarily involved in an express power. It cannot be denied that the power proposed to be exercised is an important power. As a charter of incorporation, the bill creates an artificial person previously not existing in law. It confers important civil rights and attributes which could not otherwise be claimed. It is, though not precisely similar, at least equivalent to the naturalization of an alien by which certain new civil characters are acquired by him. Would Congress have had the power to naturalize if it had not been expressly given? He proceeded next to the contemporary expositions given to the Constitution. The defense against the charge founded on the want of a Bill of Rights presupposed, he said, that the powers not given were retained and that those given were not to be extended by remote implications. On any other supposition, the power of Congress to abridge the freedom of the press or the rights of conscience, etc., could not have been disproved.
So let me interrupt right here, because I actually want to go back a couple paragraphs, because he actually talks about the creation of a new entity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, folks, let me ask you this. If the federal government had the ability to create a bank, which it didn't, why is it that the states don't have that same ability, and why have they not done that? Because it really isn't necessary, nor is it proper. See, Hamilton was a very literate man, and he understood finances really, really well. And so he had to have a catalyst to get us to this point. So I just want you to think about that, because as he's now in the final throes of actually creating this bank, and he ends up getting and winning this argument. And bottom line, it all happened because of a huge compromise on something when Hamilton and Madison were actually at odds, and we'll get into that in the next document. But go ahead, pick up where you were. I'm sorry.
No, by all means. The explanations in the state conventions all turned on the same fundamental principle. and on the principles that the terms necessary and proper gave no additional powers to those enumerated. Here he read sundry passages from the debates of the Pennsylvania, Virginia, and North Carolina conventions, showing the grounds on which the Constitution had been vindicated by its principal advocates against the dangerous latitude of its powers charged on it by its opponents. He did not undertake to vouch for the accuracy or authenticity of the publications which he quoted. He thought it probable that the sentiments delivered might in many instances have been mistaken or imperfectly noted. But the complexion of the whole, with what he himself and many others recollect, fully justified the use he had made of them.
Okay, so I'm going to interrupt again. And let me ask you this, Eric. Do you know I'm going to interrupt with this particular paragraph?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so you need to listen to the show more, because this is one of those points, folks, right here, where what does Madison point to for the legal standing of why this can't be done? He points to the ratification debates, and he actually reads from Pennsylvania, Virginia, and North Carolina conventions, showing that the grounds on which the Constitution had been vindicated or sold to these states by its principal advocates against a dangerous latitude of its powers charged on it by its opponents. In other words, they're actually going to be doing something that they said that they don't have this power to do. And he was actually pointing out the standing, the legal standing from the ratification debates, that they couldn't do this. So he actually made this argument, and sadly, this is where the Congress, see, in 1792, and as a matter of fact, folks, this is the time we're reading this debate. This is the point in time where Madison goes out and actually creates a new political party. In 1792, the Republican Party was born. And Madison actually created this because he knew that there was a new faction of Federalists, or I should say the Anti-Federalists, really co-opted the Federalists in becoming big government cabal. In other words, looking to grow government with insatiable desires. And that became antithetical to the whole point of the Constitution. And this right here is where Madison realized the real danger of what was happening. And the Republican Party didn't step into real the political limelight until after the resolutions of Virginia, which we will get to as well down the road here as we go through this very first decade of how the fight over the vehicle of the federal government, you know, instantly started going south, or I should say, all of these big government anti-federalists co-opted the other federalists. Actually, let me be clear. There were federalists that actually had the desire of big government. There were anti-federalists that were already involved in big government at the state level that didn't want the federal government to actually consume the state's powers. But what ended up happening was when the anti-federalists lost, well, the place to go where they could play get big government tactics was at the federal government. And that's why many of the anti-federalists actually ended up landing into the Senate and into the House of Representatives, which at that point started converting. You just remember, when we get into the Bill of Rights, which actually happened even before this, but we usually do this in December because that's when it was ratified, so on its anniversary, so that's when we cover that. But keeping an eye on what we're really trying to cover here, the whole point is when we looked at the Bill of Rights in December, we'll even prove to you that at that point in time when Madison tried to sell the Bill of Rights to Congress, he had a difficult time. I mean, there were so many people that he was fighting an uphill battle. And it wasn't until the state of New York and Virginia petitioned the government to call for a convention when Madison said, look, if we don't do this, there's going to be other states that actually call for a convention because they demanded a Bill of Rights. And that's why we covered all of this in the ratification debates. So Madison was really fighting, you know, this huge battle against big government. And he got to a point where in the mid-90s, he just stepped back. He just said, oh, yeah, I'm done. And he started working with Jefferson, who was at that point in time, actually out of office as well. And then he became the vice president after George Washington stepped down. He was the vice president underneath Adams. So anyway, I digress, but I really wanted to point to the legal foundation that the Constitution was sold that they couldn't do these things. And that right there, because it was a stipulation in the selling of the compact, it holds this legally binding. And these men actually turned their backs on contract law, the fundamental tenets of contract law. So I'm sorry again, Eric, but, this is why these things go long. But go ahead and pick it back up with the explanatory amendments. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's no worries. I'm glad you jumped in. And just so you know, I'm in late March of 2023 with you and Paul, Mr. Venable, discussing the ratification debate. So, yeah, I've heard you labor over this many times in these recordings.
That's okay. You know what? If there's many times when I actually say it, but I don't say it. I don't really cover it enough until we actually get beyond the ratification debates. So when I go into the resolutions, this is where Madison really starts making the assertion that this is fundamental. The whole basis of Republic Review is based on contract law. Do the parties actually have control over their compact? Actually, yes. It's the nature of compacts that the parties at any point in time can stand up and say, look, subcontractor or, little creature we created, which is the federal government, we never gave you these powers. And they can take those powers back. And again, it is all based upon this construct that the states or that the Constitution belongs to the states. Now, see, what Madison didn't do, and they didn't have the technology to do this, is to engage the states immediately. Had he actually ran out of Congress, how long would it have taken to actually get the word all the way up to Massachusetts and down to Georgia? It would have taken months to get them riled up to say, look what's going on. This is why, Congress had this autonomy. They had this, this isolation where they were able to get away with things. And the states, after it was all said and done, the states, each time they looked at it, they never saw the real danger. Now today, folks, that there's no excuse for this. The states can step in a heartbeat, in a New York minute. And so, if you know the Don Henley song. So technically, we now have the technology where the states can actually use their power and exert their power very efficaciously. And so anyway, my apologies if I said you don't listen to it enough, but, forgive me.
No, it's all good. I wish I could listen to it more, but time being what it is.
I know.
But yeah, I intend to keep going. I enjoy
it's okay.
You and Paul.
It's okay.
Very much.
But
yeah, so the technology is now there, but
absolutely. Just keep this in mind.
But the ignorance among the people is far more, I would say, than it was back then. Anyway.
Yeah, just a second. Just keep this in mind. That there is the fundamental contract laws where the states are the parties, and that the ratification debates, we do emphasize this throughout the ratification debates, that the ratification debates are the clarifications. It's literally an expansion of the terms and definitions of the compact. These are legally binding terms and definitions. And this is why he really emphasized this, and it still fell on deaf ears. These men actually turned their back. They're just like they turned their back. When we get to the resolutions, we're going to find that they not only turned their back, they came back to Jefferson and Madison and insinuated that they were trying to create an insurrection against the Constitution. That's how bad it got. That's how much big government had already consumed all of Congress by 1798. I mean, Adams was a little tyrant. Yeah. A lot of people like to quote Adams on some of these things, but we just ran out of time, Eric. I apologize. So, folks, when we come back from the break, we'll let Eric get back into Madison's debates and his argument in Congress. Now, this is a kind of a summation from the annals of Congress, but this really hits the nut, or I should say, hits the nail on the head. It cracks this nut open so we can actually see the meat of what what was really going to happen. I'll be right back.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so welcome back, folks. And actually, you know, I really do labor to do the right thing. I really try to make sure that when I make a mistake, I correct that. And so I kind of already apologized, and maybe I didn't do this right. Maybe I didn't do it as I would expect anybody else to do it. And so I want to actually do it better because we have to set the example. And so, Eric, I want to apologize publicly because I do that as a quip, and I don't mean that as offensively, but I actually understand that it's a level of frustration I have because I talk to people on a regular basis, and I say that comment, and it really does have a bad effect. And so I want to apologize for saying you don't listen to my show enough. And so,
apology accepted.
Well, so one of the things, and I appreciate that, but one of the things that's really important, because I harangue on this, that a leader, a person that's doing the right thing, when they make mistakes, they actually, you know, step up and fix the problem. So that's when I, with Bergman, so twice this year, folks, I've actually had to make public apologies, but I'm only a real man will do that. Only a real leader will actually recognize when they, and it may not be this big of a thing, and it may be kind of trite, and I'm not even trying to trite, you know, how the offense that I've created, but bottom line, it's the right thing to do to kind of do that. So I have to try better because I know that when I, it's a way of poking somebody in the eye to say, you know, you should be listening more, but it was wrong of me, and I should not have said that.
Very good. I appreciate that. And, you know, I didn't really take it so hard. It's just...
I recognized how wrong it was, and I recognized the necessity of actually clarifying that. Because, I mean, what I would just be a hypocrite if I, you know, tell people that when we do the wrong things, we need to make them right. And here I did something that was wrong. May not have been, you know, the end of the world wrong. And it may not have been, you know, something that you'd even lose sleep on. But nevertheless, at any degree, it was wrong.
Well, good on you for recognizing it and doing it. So.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for your gracious, you know, forgiving and so forth. So back to the content, folks. I apologize for stealing all of this time, but I think doing the right thing is always important. So go ahead.
All right. We continue with the explanatory amendments proposed by Congress themselves, at least, would be good authority with them. All these renunciations of power proceeded on a rule of construction, excluding the latitude now contended for. These explanations were the more to be respected, as they had not only been proposed by Congress, but ratified by nearly three-fourths of the states. He read several of the articles proposed, remarking particularly on the 11th and 12th, the 9th and 10th Amendments, the former as guarding against a latitude of interpretation, the latter as excluding every source of power not within the Constitution itself. With all this evidence, of the sense in which the Constitution was understood and adopted, will it not be said, if the bill should pass, that its adoption was brought about by one set of arguments, and that it is now administered under the influence of another set? And this reproach will have the keener sting because it is applicable to so many individuals concerned in both the adoption and administration. In fine, or fine, if the power were in the Constitution, the immediate exercise of it cannot be essential. If not there, the exercise of it involves the guilt of usurpation and establishes a precedent of interpretation, leveling all the barriers which limit the powers of the general government and protect those of the state governments. If the point be doubtful only, respect for ourselves, who ought to shun the appearance of precipitancy, and ambition, respect for our successors, who ought not lightly to be deprived of the opportunity of exercising the rights of legislation, respect for our constituents, who have had no opportunity of making known their sentiments, and who are themselves to be bound down to the measure for so long a period, all these considerations require that the irrevocable decision should at least be suspended until another session. It appeared on the whole, he concluded, that the power exercised by the bill was condemned by the silence of the Constitution, was condemned by the rule of interpretation arising out of the Constitution, was condemned by its tendency to destroy the main characteristic of the Constitution, was condemned by the expositions of the friends of the Constitution, whilst depending before the public, was condemned by the apparent intention of the parties which ratified the Constitution, was condemned by the explanatory amendments proposed by Congress themselves to the Constitution, and he hoped it would receive its final condemnation by the vote of this House. Speech of Fisher Ames, Massachusetts, February 3rd, 1791. Shall I continue with this?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Mr. Ames, little doubt remains with respect to the utility of banks. This, however, is not a question of expediency, but of duty. We are not at liberty to examine which of several modes of acting is entitled to the preference, but we are solemnly warned against acting at all. We are told that the Constitution will not authorize Congress to incorporate the subscribers to the bank. Let us examine the Constitution, and if that forbids our proceeding, we must reject the bill, though we shall do it with deep regret that such an opportunity to serve our country must be suffered to escape for the want of a constitutional power to improve it. While the exercise of even the lawful powers of government is disputed and a jealous eye is fixed on its proceedings, not a whisper has been heard against its authority to establish a bank. Still, however unseasonably, the old alarm of public discontent is sounded in our ears. Two questions occur. May Congress exercise any powers which are not expressly given in the Constitution, but may be deduced by a reasonable construction of that instrument? And secondly, will such a construction warrant the establishment of the bank? Man, you can feel this. Can you not feel it?
Yeah.
Can you not?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my goodness. The doctrine that powers may be implied which are not expressly vested in Congress has long been a bugbear to a great many worthy persons. They apprehend that Congress, by putting constructions upon the Constitution, will govern by its own arbitrary discretion, and therefore that it ought to be bound to exercise the powers expressly given, and those only. If Congress may not make laws conformably to the powers plainly implied, though not expressed in the frame of government, it is rather late in the day to adopt it as a principle of conduct. A great part of our 2 years' labor is lost, and worse than lost to the public, for we have scarcely made a law in which we have not exercised our discretion with regard to the true intent of the Constitution. Any words but those used in the instrument will be liable to a different interpretation. The danger of implied power does not arise from its assuming a new principle. We have not only practiced it often, but we can scarcely proceed without it. Nor does the danger proceed so much from the extent of the power as from its uncertainty. While the opposers of the bank exclaim against the exercise of this power by Congress, Do they mark out the limits of the power which they will leave to us with more certainty than is done by the advocates of the bank? There are rules of interpretation by contemporaneous testimony, the debates of conventions, and the doctrine of substantive and auxiliary powers will be found as obscure and, of course, as formidable as that which they condemn. They only set up one construction against another. If, therefore, some interpretation of the Constitution may be indulged, by what rules is it to be governed? The great end of every association of persons or states is to effect the end of its institution. Congress may do what is necessary to the end for which the Constitution was adopted, provided it is not repugnant to the natural rights of man, or to those which they have expressly reserved to themselves, or to the powers which are assigned to the states. This rule of interpretation seems to be a safe and not a very uncertain one, independently of the Constitution itself. By that instrument, certain powers are specifically delegated, together with all powers necessary and proper to carry them into execution. That construction may be maintained to be a safe one, which promotes the good of the society and the ends for which the government was adopted, without impairing the rights of any man or the powers of any state.
So right here, he actually laid it out that he believes implied powers exist.
Okay.
Congress may do what is necessary to the end for which the Constitution was adopted. In other words, hey, we created this national government. Can't we imply that it can do what it needs to do?
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
So right there, he's actually starting to lay that out. Now, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. That's good. Okay. He then asked whether it appeared on this view of the subject that the establishment of a national bank would be a violent misinterpretation of the Constitution. He did not contend for an arbitrary, unlimited discretion in the government to do everything. He took occasion to protest against such a misconception of his argument. He had noticed the great marks by which the construction of the Constitution he conceived must be guided and limited. And these, if not absolutely certain, were very far from being arbitrary or unsafe. It is for the House to judge whether the construction which denies the power of Congress is more definite and safe. He adverted to the preamble of the Constitution, which declares that it is established for the general welfare of the Union. This vested Congress with the authority over all objects of national concern or of a general nature. A national bank undoubtedly came under this idea, and though not specially mentioned, yet the general design and tendency of the Constitution proved more evidently the constitutionality of the system than its silence in this particular could be construed to express the contrary. Wow. Okay.
So let me ask you this. Do you think he understood the coming of, one, the Federal Reserve, and then ultimately the U.S. digital currency?
I think he understood the coming of the central bank. I think he understood that, yes. Digital, I don't know. I don't know what he could have known, even though they seem to have this almost inhuman prescience, but I don't know.
So one of the things that they were constrained in the Constitution was they could only coin money of gold and silver or of precious metals, because they included copper for the pennies of the currency when they established the Treasury Act of 1792. And so when we look at how this all really lays out, weren't these men biblically based? Wasn't Ames somebody that actually, Ames was a very godly man. Did he not see the connection between what he was arguing for and what was stated in Revelations, that we would get to a point where everything you bought and sold must be done by a mark?
I see what you're saying. Okay, well, yeah. So you could argue that the prescience that they seem to have definitely came from biblical studies, which which sure does speak highly to getting the Bible back in school. But anyway.
Well, they had it in their school then, though.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, it was not present. What I'm saying is that Ames did not have the breadth. In other words, you know, and I know that they were saying prayer in Congress at this point in time to guide them. But I, you know, I believe that the Lord allows us to make these mistakes. You know, he guided us in doing things right when they were actually, and I think that the establishment of the Constitution was his work. And they took their time. They painstakingly debated things. Now, when they finally got there, I don't think that they painstakingly debated all of these issues to say, you know, maybe we should, you know, pray about this, and maybe we should all lay it on the table. What is the true spirit of the Constitution? I mean, here's a guy that was a really a good guy, but he was doing Hamilton's bidding. He actually got wooed by the soothsayer himself.
Anyway,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I don't, you know, who knows how much of his internal, his frailty played a part in, you know, being unconscious to this coming. But
right, correct. Yeah. Okay, go ahead. He had no desire.
Okay. He had no desire to extend the powers granted by the Constitution beyond the limits prescribed them. But in cases where there was doubt as to its meaning and intention, he thought it his duty to consult his conscience and judgment to solve them. And even if doubts did still remain on two different interpretations of it, he would constantly embrace that the least involved in doubt. Opinions on the constitutionality of the bank bill solicited by President George Washington. Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson's opinion, February 15, 1791. Go on here?
Yep. Yeah. Go ahead. Keep going.
I consider the foundation of the Constitution as laid on this ground that all powers not delegated to the U.S. by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states or to the people. 12th Amendment. To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power no longer susceptible of any definition. The incorporation of a bank and other powers assumed by this bill have not, in my opinion, been delegated to the U.S. by the Constitution. One, they are not among the powers specially enumerated. Two, nor are they within either of the general phrases, which are the two following. The second general phrase is to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution the enumerated powers. But they can all be carried into execution without a bank. A bank, therefore, is not necessary and consequently not authorized by this phrase. It has been much urged that a bank will give great facility or convenience in the collection of taxes. Suppose this were true, yet the Constitution only allows the means which are necessary, not those which are merely convenient for effecting the enumerated powers. If such a latitude of construction be allowed to this phrase, as to give any non-enumerated power, it will go to every one, for there is no one which ingenuity may not torture into a convenience, in some way or other, to some one of so long a list of enumerated powers. It would swallow up all the delegated powers and reduce the whole to one phrase as before observed. Therefore, it was that the Constitution restrained them to the necessary means, that is to say, to those means without which the grant of the power would be nugatory.
Okay, and then finally, the opinion of Hamilton, the mastermind himself. Go ahead.
The Secretary of the Treasury, having perused with attention the papers containing the opinions of the Secretary of State and the Attorney General concerning the constitutionality of the bill for establishing a national bank, proceeds, according to the order of the President, to submit the reasons which have induced him to entertain a different opinion. The first of these arguments is that the foundation of the Constitution is laid on this ground, that all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited to it by the states are reserved to the states or to the people, whence it is meant to be inferred that Congress can in no case exercise any power not included in those enumerated in the Constitution. It is affirmed that the power of erecting a corporation is not included in any of the enumerated powers. To this mode of reasoning, respecting the right of employing all the means requisite to the execution of the specified powers of the government, it is objected that none but necessary and proper means are to be employed. And the Secretary of State maintains that no means are to be considered as necessary, but those without which the grant of the power would be nugatory. Nay, so far does he go in this restrictive interpretation of the word as even to make the case of necessity, which shall warrant the constitutional exercise of a power, to depend on casual and temporary circumstances. An idea which alone refutes the construction. The expediency of exercising a particular power at a particular time must indeed depend on circumstances, but the constitutional right of exercising it must be uniform and invariable, the same today as tomorrow. It is essential to the being of the national government that so erroneous a conception of the meaning of the word necessary should be exploded. It is certain that neither the grammatical nor popular sense of the term requires that construction. According to both, necessary often means no more than needful, requisite, incidental, useful, or conducive to. It is a common mode of expression to say that it is necessary for a government or a person to do this or that thing, when nothing more is intended or understood, than that the interests of the government or person require or will be promoted by the doing of this or that thing. The imagination can be at no loss for exemplifications of the use of the word in this sense. And it is the true one in which it is to be understood, as used in the Constitution. The whole turn of the clause containing it indicates that it was the intent of the Federal Convention, by that clause, to give a liberal latitude to the exercise of the specified powers. The expressions have peculiar comprehensiveness. They are to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. To understand the word as the Secretary of State does would be to depart from its obvious and popular sense and to give it a restrictive operation, an idea never before entertained. It would be to give it the same force as if the word absolutely or indispensably had been prefixed to it. Such a construction would beget endless uncertainty and embarrassment. The cases must be palpable and extreme in which it could be pronounced with certainty that a measure was absolutely necessary, or one without which the exercise of a given power would be nugatory. There are few measures of any government which would stand so severe a test. To insist upon it would be to make the criterion of the exercise of any implied power a case of extreme necessity, which is rather a rule to justify the overleaping of the bounds of the constitutional authority than to govern the ordinary exercise of it. The degree in which a measure is necessary can never be a test of the legal right to adopt it. That must ever be matter of opinion and can only be a test of expediency. The relation between the measure and the end, between the nature of the mean employed towards the execution of a power and the object of that power, must be the criterion of constitutionality, not the more or less of necessity or utility.
So a good lawyer takes you away from the black and white side of the argument and leads you philosophically into the space of ideas and ideals. A good lawyer will start to bend and get one to really see that you can ignore the black and white for the ideal. And so here he clearly states that, you know, clearly creating this bank is not necessary at this point in time, but it would be necessary at maybe some point if we had some level of urgency or exigency. Because that's what he talks about a few paragraphs up. Hamilton was a snake in the grass, and as a matter of fact, I don't know if you knew this, but when Jefferson and Madison discussed Hamilton, they referred to him as the creature.
No, I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, and so this actually comes out in Dumas Malone's six-book series on Thomas Jefferson. And in Dumas Malone's book, he really points out how Jefferson has, I don't want to say controls over, but he actually utilizes Madison because he knows Madison has the grasp of these issues far better. Because, you know, if you look at what, if you go back up and you look at what Jefferson said, then Jefferson goes, you know, into the black and white argument, and he doesn't spend a lot of time. I mean, it's not even a full page of his argument. But when you look at what Hamilton speaks, he goes into theory, you know, and dives into these things, and you go, oh my gosh, I mean, this is incredible. So
yes, he's very beguiling, and Soothsayer is good because I think of his words in the Federalist Papers as being soothing and beguiling. So yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, and Ames himself, you know, was a very long oration of the necessity and implied powers. And this is where the concept of implied powers started growing. Now, bottom line, what they should have said, but nobody did say this, that had, and as a matter of fact, I go out because the bank became such a big issue. I actually went through all the ratification debates. You know how many times the word bank was even mentioned, just mentioned, in the ratification debates?
Okay, was it less than a small handful, six?
It was less than one handful. Two.
Fantastic. I think I actually heard you say that.
Only
before, yeah.
Two times, and never was it in context that the government itself, it referenced, I think, Holland and a bank, and I forget the other context, but it had no reference at all that the federal government would be creating a bank. So here's the ultimate charge. If this would have been included in the Constitution, would the states have ratified it?
Nice. I doubt it.
Based on the arguments against, you know, taking this type of latitude or actually enumerating this, that they would create a bank. Because these men knew the banks were institutions of money. It's a corporation. And one, they're capable of failing in the wrong hands, which is what happened. The National Bank had failed several times. The only reason the Federal Reserve has never failed is because it is in the hands of the Rothschilds and the global bankers.
Yeah, it's going to fail soon, I would say.
Well, so I don't think so. I think that it will basically sweep aside because it is now being entrenched into the digital currency.
I see what you're saying. On the one hand, I think, well, if they can simply print money, why can't they print it forever? However, right, there are certain things such as treasuries and whatnot. That's beyond my knowledge. But
we got five seconds left. I hate to say it, but we'll see if we can get you to come back, folks. We're really out of time at this point. And so this is just the tip of the iceberg regarding the Assumption Act. Now we're going to actually go backwards. And now we're going to actually look at what created this argument of creating the bank, which really was the assumption of the debts. And so I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.